are back. We back. Yep, in the house. Podcast. Hey, Patrick Chappelle
like
here.
I feel like I want to put that yo like a little earlier than when I normally put in the mic, you know, like earlier in the intro song, so it catches people off guard.
Yeah, like, whoa.
Let's wake people up with it.
Yes, I love that. I'm a pretty jumpy person in movies. Big sounds just make me jump. I was watching Inception not that long ago and was jumping so much. And I've seen that movie like multiple times. Like I knew what was coming and still was jumping at all the big musical moments. It was very, very hilarious. My friend Zach was like laughing at how much I was jumping in the movie. It was so funny. Okay, hey, welcome back to the podcast. Patrick Chappelle here. So glad that you're with us again. Man, I hope that your weekend was a good one and now you're ready for another delicious episode. I don't know why delicious sounds weird, but it does. And but we're going to say it. Delicious episode. It's good. It will fill you up. It'll fill you up. So today we have Melissa Green. Y'all, Melissa and I have been trying to make this happen for a while, but this sister is a speaker, singer, writer, pastor. She officiates weddings. She has done so many wonderful things in her life. She started Coat with a bunch of other folks, a wonderful thing called Imaginarium that is here in Nashville. You'll hear a little bit about that, a little about her journey, and just some insights that she has been having of late. I love this episode. Melissa is a dear friend. And for you Enneagram lovers out there, a fellow eight, holla to the A's. That is not even what you're supposed to do with that. I don't know. We got to have another Enneagram episode because y'all are still out here in these streets acting wild with the Enneagram. That's okay. Y'all are wild. Oh, man. Okay, but Melissa's great. You're going to love it. Thanks again so much for all the support. Make sure that you are following the podcast, following us on Instagram, leaving those 5 stars, leaving a comment and a review in iTunes. That is so helpful, more than you ever would know. Thank you for doing that. And take care of yourselves out there, folks. Take care of yourselves. Find time to just breathe and walk around and just slow your life down, because I know that things have been ramping up and been this and that. Like, just take care of yourselves. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other and continue to reach out to the people that you love. So even as we progress along in this summer, I just encourage you to reach out to people you haven't reached out to in a while. Throw out that text message, that phone call. It may mean more than you ever will know to the person receiving it, because they haven't heard from you in some time. So I encourage you, that's my encouragement for you today, is to reach out to those that may have been estranged from you for a while, or that you haven't talked to in a hot minute. Okay, Ben, what is happening,
Patrick,
over there? Hey, you have a dope hat on, man. That's a cool hat.
Thank you. This is a Living Waters hat.
Shout out to Living Water.
Living Waters Brewery in particular.
Living Waters Brewery. Yeah.
I don't know if this is the brewery same logo.
And, yeah, it is. It's the coffee shop and brewery.
Yeah. Off Trinity Lane, right next to the new Grimey's location.
That's right.
I have admittedly only had their coffee, but it is delicious, and am good friends with one of their baristas there. But I've heard that their curation of beers and other drinks is amazing. So highly recommend
no
that.
Doubt. Yeah.
Not a sponsor, but
yeah, could be. We're looking for sponsors, people. Come on. But yeah, so definitely check that out. And I will forever be a person that will encourage you, whether you live in Nashville or wherever you're living, support local businesses, support local coffee shops, breweries, restaurants, retailers. They need your love. They need that love. Support them.
Yeah, and if you're at all concerned, this is, we've been talking a weird amount about one place for an episode intro, but Living Waters is actually really, really safe with their whole method of working with customers. They're wearing masks and gloves. They keep a really good distance from you. You also can order on their website and they can bring it out to your car. They can deliver it to you. And lots of restaurants in Nashville are able to do lots of things like that. So just like my theory is if you have the option of doing some sort of contactless thing, pick that option.
Oh, absolutely.
If not, you know, be as safe as you can.
We should have been contactless for a while. Why are we having so much contact?
This is going to be a great just like shift in general that was much needed. We're kind of gross.
Oh, we're very gross. You need to, if you haven't washed your hands already, folks, pause the podcast, go wash your hands, because you probably haven't washed them in a hot minute. Go wash your hands, because your hands are dirty.
The song that's about to come in before the interview starts is probably going to be 20 seconds worth of music, which is perfect for you to wash your hands. So when that song starts playing, start washing your hands. That'll be your cue.
I love it. All right, folks. Hey, I hope you enjoy this interview with Melissa, and we will see you next time. Okay, Melissa. You're here. You're on the podcast.
I'm here, finally, on the podcast. Thank you for asking me.
We've been wanting to record this, I want to say, for a little while at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm excited for...
Me too.
...the world. I don't know if the world hears this, but it's out in the world.
Yes.
which is just as good, I think. So... we're just going to see where we go. There's a couple things I'm interested in, because I think that the folks that listen to the podcast, from what I gather, are from all over the country. We even have some world listeners, so that's good. I love that. So hello to all the international listeners. We love you. But I guess I'm interested, and I think that everybody else will be interested, especially with the work that you're up to here in Nashville, Tennessee, and it's been quite a journey. So I kind of want to talk about that. So let's just, we'll hop in and we'll probably catch some bio backlog things as we chat. But like, tell the folks what you're up to these days.
These days, woo!
These trying times.
Oh my God. Without focusing on all the negative that is happening.
Right.
First, these days, ultimately, I am up to, so I co-founded and lead a nonprofit called Imaginarium. And we are ultimately a non-religious yet spiritual space to imagine a better world and intentionally make it so. We are going to celebrate 3 years in August. I know.
That's amazing.
3 years in August. And yes, we have a ton of programs. I actually did a thing this week because we had a ton of new followers come into our online space because someone had done a word of mouth situation. So I was trying to give like, hey, let me re-explain like who, why, where, right. What we do. And so ultimately we are a community in Nashville and we try to serve that community. Especially we tend to attract people that are either post-religious people because they were hurt in religious spaces or never quite found their place in religious spaces.
Yeah.
And we have these centering values of the belief in the inherent worth and magic of every living human and living thing. So we name the world around us as well. Second, our inherent connection that we have then to the human family and to the world around us. And finally, and equally, our inherent responsibility to each other and to the world around us. And daily, trying to understand, you know, inherent worth of magic and connection. Mm-hmm. And then what is my responsibility? So we're not ones to tell people what your responsibility is as much as help remind people that you do indeed have a responsibility. So we do that for that on for that community on the ground in Nashville. But then we also have an online space, much like you do in this podcast,
right,
where people come and can be inspired and challenged and hopefully learn and grow with us too, but are not necessarily on the ground. Right. So I lead that with an amazing team of people and deep conversation partners. And I've tried to do, although I lead it and I know I'm a leader, I've tried to do it in a and continually do it in a non-hierarchical way. And we're trying to be a non-hierarchical space. So that means leadership looks like coming alongside people, and leadership looks like giving up space and partnering with others and making room for others to speak and teach us and grow with us too. So yeah, that's where I'm at literally right now in the middle of the summer in 2020. I just finished my master's. I just graduated in May. Yeah, I got a master's of divinity. So that's been new and exciting, and I'm trying to sort of understand what the world looks like, because in the 3 years that I've co-founded this and been growing this, I've also been in grad school and had like side hustle jobs, because I stepped away from a church job and lost a bunch of money, but was peaceful about it. But, you know, so life has been crazy these last 3 years. But now the grad school's over, it's just opening up a world to like breathe and, oh, what would I like to read that I just want to read, not because I have to read, right?
Right.
So, yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
Huh. So I guess take me to the decision. So Imaginarium starts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as you all are, as this initial Genesis team gets together,
mm-hmm.
and you have a blank canvas, and you all kind of, it seems, deliberately said, we want to lean heavily in just, we are this nonprofit that kind of has these values and these, this vision and direction versus, you know, like you said, you came out of church world versus saying, let's build another church, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. And like, what was kind of, because I'm sure that was an intentional move and, yes. and not accidental.
Yeah. So it's twofold, I like to say. On one hand, I was a part of a progressive Christian community. That's where I was pastoring prior to this. I pastored there 8 years and effectively was co-pastoring, but was named the associate pastor. Within that community, we in my last 6 to 12 months there, we were sort of on a journey headed towards what Imaginarium has become. We were explaining to our people sort of where the leadership was and where the community was, because it was not a monolith. Everybody was not on the same page, and right. they never really are in a church community, but often that's not named. And so we started exploring things literally from not just from behind the scenes as leadership, but also like from the pulpit with the community, talking about sort of a spectrum of where you can be and still label yourself Christian. And I know that spectrum is sure. broad and wide, but so anyways, it was sort of a beautiful thing to just take the church onto that journey with us, to be really honest again about the leadership's questions and doubts and the ways that we were exploring not just faith, but life and humanity and God and divinity and will of God and direction of God. I mean, all these questions. And that sort of set me off in the direction of where Imaginarium has gone, right? I wanted to do that at first and thought we could do that within a church and sure. within that church. And for lots of reasons, realized we couldn't. A lot of people were afraid of change. A lot of people wanted the comfort of quit pushing us. Want to come Sunday morning and be comforted because the world is hard enough, which I respect that. But that lack of certainty threw a lot of people off. Whereas I and churches still can do this. And I think this church I was a part of is now doing this in a really lovely, healthy way, as best I can know from the outside. I think you can still push for curiosity and let that be a virtue. But there was something about the institutional space of church, period. Not just that church, but of every institutional space that has a structure in such a way that you're bound to some things. And I, as an individual, and I, as part of wanting to create and be a part of something that doesn't have those boundaries. And often those boundaries can be very protective of people. They really can, but they can also be limiting.
Yeah.
And I just found it ended up being too limiting. And I was surrounded by others that also thought we were more limited than we were protected or comforted. And so what does it look like then to create a space? Like, we kept coming back to this word space. Like, what does it mean to name the space, is to try to create space that can have deep accountability to something. So thus those centering values that I mentioned earlier, and the idea of the non-hierarchical, although I'm leading, I'm with a team of people that I check in with on every point. I'm making no decisions by myself. And then a board and conversation partners. We had a advisory council in our startup phase too.
Yeah.
So anyways, that space though, that can ultimately like set forth to try and experiment, but also be a space in a non-institutional way that says, and if something isn't working, or if we do something that is harmful, or if these practices end up being healthy for some, but not for all, then we can grow and change and shape and evolve as needed. And that idea of an institution does not really set yourself up to allow for that.
Right.
So that is why, I mean, that was sort of the impetus. And I was having conversations with, this is always sort of a genesis moment for Imaginarium too, was I was bringing in through a friend of a friend. We had a friend who was a Muslim man who had founded a Muslim community here in Nashville. And at the church I was at, our youth happened to be having a lot of questions around Islam and the Muslim community. And so we said, well, why don't we bring in somebody to talk to you?
Like, naturally, as we do, as we should do.
Versus just teaching or being as someone on the outside, exposing you to these things. Let's bring in somebody. So the man who I was introduced to through the friend of a friend, his name's Dayoud Abu Diab. And he said, let's go to breakfast. And I was like, great, let's go talk, you know, before you come in. Because I also was the pastor at the time, sort of being, I needed to know who I was bringing in and, right, and what he was wanting to talk about. And this was across the board for any speakers.
Oh, sure.
Not because he was Muslim, just to clarify.
Yeah, that's good. Which is so, what you anyways, do anyway. Yeah, you want to, right, yeah, if you're in charge of any organization, you want to know who is this person that's coming
exactly
in to talk. Yeah.
I just wanted to clarify. So Dayoud and I went to breakfast and literally hit it off. He had, as much as I was going in to like research him, he had spent the evening beforehand researching me and watching multiple sermons that I'd preached that were accessible online. And he was like, you're trouble. And I was like, I mean, yes. I mean, I say that, yes.
Yes, I am.
And he was like, I love it. And we ended up just realizing we have so much in common, so much our perspective on the world. Although we've come from very different experiences in lots of ways, our perspective and stance to the world is almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
And so I walked away from that breakfast so inspired, and I walked away really longing to have more space to be in community or the same theology, ultimately, that we shared this humanity together, and we wanted to make the world better. And we both were trying in our own way to make the world better and different. And so that was like a seed planted, like, okay, later come to Imaginarium and let's create a space where Dayoud and I are literally not guests in each other's places, but a part of literally the same community too. And
yeah,
so since then, he's on our board. He's still on our board. And he and his wife, Robin, and their family are a part of our family. I mean, it was the beginning of a lovely relationship.
That's
so
awesome. Yeah.
So yeah. So all of that was how and why we started.
Right. So I guess, so to even go back a little bit, like, you know, 16, 18-year-old Melissa, does she have any idea, like, this, is this even something close? Does she think, like, I'm going to be a pastor one day, and then I'm going to start a nonprofit one day, I'm going to do all of these things that you're up to now. Like, how, like, explain some of that journey that, you know, that took you from.
Yeah.
Because what, you're from which hometown?
I was born in Milton, Pensacola, Florida, which is in the Panhandle.
Oh,
but then I
yeah.
moved down to the Tampa area when I was 2 and grew up there.
Yeah.
So 16-year-old Melissa. Now, 16-year-old Melissa was strong-willed.
Some of it was there.
Was pushing back on authority figures in my life, especially I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. I grew up in a very conservative, like mega church. Like, and I consider it fundamentalist now. So the 16-year-old Melissa, the similarities are the strong-willed, willing to ask and push back on authority.
Right.
I felt at the time the language I would have used, like called by God to use my voice, and specifically my voice thinking and singing.
Right.
In full-time ministry to serve the world. Like, that was the language I used then.
Yeah.
And that was the trajectory that I was going on. The challenger, Melissa, was in that church figuring out my way when I heard things from the pulpit that did not resonate, not just with my soul, but with what I understood to be who God was and how God worked. And so I've talked about this a lot in interviews, but unfortunately, the pastor said one time from the pulpit, and I think I was maybe in 8th or 9th grade, he said, "You're unequally yoked if you date, much less marry someone of a different race or color."
Wow.
And I remember, being like, wait a second. Now, that church was predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
I went, though, to a public school, which was thankfully very diverse.
Right.
And I had friends and relationships, and I cheered and whatnot, and, you know, traveled with the football team. And so I was surrounded by diversity. And so all of a sudden I was like, okay, wait. The pastor who, you know, and church was my everything. I mean, I brought my Bible to school with me. I was leading the prayer groups, you know? And so, but that was really one of the first times that I was like, okay,
wait a minute.
That doesn't seem right. And so what do I do with that? And so that questioning started early on, and that has continued a part of my life and continued to shape who Melissa is now, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But Melissa then was, you know, sweet, conservative, you know, my boldness was that bringing the Bible to school. Like, that's my way of being bold at the time. I went to college. I ended up going to a liberal arts college that was Church of God
based.
Nice. So this Baptist bubble got popped quickly because all of a sudden I was surrounded by other Christians that had very different ideas of what scripture, not just what it said, but how we interpreted, very different ideas of how to, you know, at the time, the questions I was asking, like how to get to heaven and can you keep your salvation or lose your salvation? You know, those things were not Baptist ways, but the Church of God Pentecostal view was very different than that. So all of a sudden, again, I had to be like, okay, so these are good people who name themselves Christians too. And what do we do when they have very different answers to the questions that I've been given? So that set me off on a trajectory of reading and continuing to expose myself to not just the people that were saying the same things that I believe, but what other people believe, which at the time, and I laugh at this and I've said this before, but like, that was like, okay, so I'll read Billy Graham and I'll read Dr. Tony Evans because they're different. Right.
That's so great.
And they were different.
Yes. But
not
yes.
different as I thought I would.
You were radical. That was radical. But yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So that travel, I've said multiple times over and continue to believe this and try to instill this in my kids, but traveling the world and reading have been the best shapers of my life, right? The best way that I have been challenged and exposed, and my eyes and ears and heart and mind has been opened, that I don't have it all figured out and what needs to change in the way that I live, in the way that I believe, in the way that I speak, in order to actually honor this world around me.
Yeah. So I guess what was like the moment? Because like you've said, you got this Southern Baptist, then you have this Church of God. Now you're kind of this adult. And then like the hat, I mean, is there a, like, can you think back to a moment where it's like, okay, here is where like it really, it, all of the stuff, all of this of my past, kind of like I was able to step into this newness, because even the church you were at is several clicks, you know, forward than like those things, even though like those were each clicks in and of themselves. But like, what was kind of like one of the last, like, what was, do you have a moment? Is there a moment, or was
there
it just kind of, okay.
No, moments. There are moments. Definitely.
Yeah.
It was, living and being in relationship with several friends that, are gay. And yeah. at the time being very conservative and starting off with my perspective of them, like, well, God loves you, but hates the sin. Like, that's definitely where I started.
Right.
And then the more I traveled with them and was face to face with their full humanity, changing my mind on all of that and better understanding that it was shifting then my theology then mm-hmm. when I better understood, you know, when I was faced with life versus backing down backing up and saying, well, my theology is this, even though life is showing me this. I let life offer questions or circumstances and then turned around and put all that on. Like, if my theology is true and real, then it can hold all of this.
Right.
And often I realized my theology could not hold it. So what does that mean? You know, it was my travel to spaces like Africa where I'm spouting off, you know, scripture
right.
and saying things in front of these people that are living a very different reality than my white, privileged, comfortable Western reality, and realizing that the way that I'm using that scripture is actually weaponizing, right, in that moment. And so if my theology doesn't also work in this spot in the remote, you know, Ivory Coast of Africa, then it's, I think my theology doesn't work. Like, something needs to shift here.
Right.
It was the first time that Obama was up for office. I was still in a contemporary Christian singing group
mm-hmm.
and in a very still conservative bubble, although I'd grown and expanded a lot, but realizing that the things that Obama stood for, that I stood for, and that although even at the time I couldn't wrap my head, I couldn't argue theologically why I supported fully my LGBTQ friends and their right to marriage specifically at the time.
Right.
I felt it in my heart, and I felt for their civil liberties and that they deserved this. And so, like, I was like, okay, I'm voting for Obama. Like, I understand. And that was, I was like ostracized.
I'm sure you were.
in my little bubble then, it was like, who are you? Like, yeah. what? So that.
It's expected for me to vote for Obama. Like, it was like, okay, he's, you know, we love him, but he's going to vote for that guy.
Right. Yeah. And then here I am like, oh no, I think I might be Democrat. Like, I think I need to shift some things to line up with, again, my life and my experiences. And so it was all those little ticks. It was also, I was traveling. I traveled and helped to lead a prison ministry for 5 years during my time at that church. But it was the first time I was in prison. And we took a concert to prison. And at first it was like, this will be sweet. Like, we'll go take a concert. Really encourage the people. And it was in the moment. It was the day of... December, I wish I could remember the date. It was a Christmas tour. It was December, the day of the Sandy Hook shootings.
Oh, yeah.
We had done a concert that morning for one federal. We went to these, Florida has like 68 federal prisons.
Oh,
like,
my goodness.
Crazy. The second or third largest in the country, the state's prisons. Anyways, so we had done one that morning, and then the news broke. We were in the hotel, and then we were going back into a different prison that night. And I remember sort of coming face to face with the reality that I was choosing to go in to sing to not the victims of a crime such as this, but to the perpetrators, to the ones that did the crime, or at least have been convicted, and some of them rightfully and some of them not.
Right.
But that was a shift too in my theology and understanding, okay, Melissa, do I actually understand that every human is beloved of God? Do I actually understand that at the core, every human is inherently worthy, and what I now use the word magic? And if I do, can I go in to this prison tonight knowing the harm that they could cause, can I still go in and use my platform in such a way to encourage and remind these individuals of who they actually are at their core, not what they've done, not to support what they've done or diminish what they've done, but to be a mirror to them, to reflect back sort of the heart of who they are. And that was a big shift for me too. And so, I mean, it's been so many things, Patrick, and I'm I'm grateful that, and I think it is, I think that's true with all of us. But some of us don't allow our life experiences to continue to shape and mold us. And I think I wasn't set up for that. Like, I was set up with a worldview, an idea like, here, you're going to be given all the answers. Yeah. You just need to grow into them. Just grow into your answers. But here's your list. It's like, I was given that, I feel like, at 10 years old. You know,
oh, absolutely.
Right. And so, instead, oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, you're going. Go ahead.
But instead, those answers, allowing those answers to serve me until I realized either they didn't serve me or they did not actually serve the people around me or the world around me in a greater way. And again, so back to being, the more I was exposed to more of the world or to read, you know, through books and through knowledge, the more I kept going, okay, it's not, I think there's better answers. And then I was like, okay, I actually think there's better questions.
Yeah.
Like, I think those are a waste of our time at this point because we're missing the point. And
And that's so true that sometimes we find ourselves asking not the right questions or not even enough questions. I've often see that people don't ask enough questions. And that's something that I'm curious as I talk to many people who work in spaces with a variety of different types of people, but especially in your journey, and you've kind of existed in a lot of different faith-related spaces. And so my question then becomes, why, at least from your perspective, why do you think that so many people are resistant to curiosity, resistant to questions and to uncertainty? Because you're right. Like, we love certainty, especially those of us that find ourselves in faith communities. Certainty seems to be the thing you want, not curiosity, not uncertainty, not, you know, this kind of not mystical even approach. Like, we love this side and not really the other. So what, I mean, you've talked to, I'm sure, so many people throughout your life. So like, what do you kind of, if you had to kind of give a shot at, like, here's why that is or why you think that is, what would be your response to that?
I wish I knew.
Right.
I mean, my best response to that is, it's often that if you're not affected by said thing, then you are often unwilling to change.
Yeah.
You are unwilling to see, like, not just not change yourself, but also unwilling to see and honor the reality of someone else's experience. And I think, again, I think the systems and the institutions that so many of us have grown up in have furthered, like, pushed that down into us, like, that, okay, it's okay because it's for you. Like, it's a very selfish, ultimately,
yes,
a very personal, selfish, aka personal journey you're on, right? And so I think everyone's so, and people are so, at least the people that I grew up with, you're so afraid of hell, like this idea of some afterlife hell, that you're like, no, let me batten down the hatches and just stick to what I know to be true and like shield myself from actually the living hell that happens in this world, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the why. I put faults on us as humans. I also put a lot of faults on systems and institutions that reinforce those things.
Well, so, and that's so true, even what you're saying, which is like, if it doesn't directly affect me, then, like, I don't really want to give myself my energy, my compassion, my care for any of, I mean, listen, we're living in such a time right now, right? When it comes to COVID, like, people are like, well, it hasn't affected me yet. So, like, I'm going to go just do whatever. And even when it comes to racism and injustice, and it as relates around race, it's like, or like you were saying with the LGBTQIA, it's like, if it doesn't personally, it's like, but especially those of faith, and I would say this is true for a lot of the faiths that are out there, there is this communal piece to it that we read about, but then we so often like reject this idea of like being fully communal in that way.
Right, because often community actually is under the AKA means my church community. It is not the broader community.
That's good.
It is not taught or preached or encouraged to be like this broader human family. Even if you believe only the body of Christ are people that confess to a certain way to be Christian, right? You're still not even technically seeing yourself as fully connected to that. And that was even part of my journey, like realizing, oh, Melissa, I'm a Christian, and this is what it feels like to be like a white Christian in America. And then you get in Africa, and I'm like, oh, yeah, but these are Christians. Or even, oh, yeah, these other, you know, Pentecostals are Christian, too. Uh-huh. And how are you responsible and honor them and what they feel and, you know, their thoughts about scripture. And then much less when I get to Africa and realize, oh, gosh, these Christians. But then I've obviously moved beyond even just the idea of Christian. And that's why with Imaginarium, I'm like, we are connected to the human family and the world around us, like, and the natural world. Like, so own that, like, become aware of that.
Yes.
Han says, maybe awake to the illusion of our separateness. Like, that is an illusion that we are actually separate. And I believe the truth is we are actually all connected. And thus then we do carry a responsibility, and you can't be all things to all people at all time. Like, you can't, but
sure.
The opposite of that is not to pull back and only make decisions for yourself. Like,
yeah.
And you're hurting. I think you're hurting yourself when
yes.
you do that. Like that idea that, well, I'm protecting me. You're actually not. You're living a diminished life. Like, that is my own experience and understanding that when I make choices strictly for myself, totally. And I don't mean like self-help. I mean, like, because that's a whole, we can focus on how there's a diminished idea of understanding our own inherent worth and how to best care for ourselves. That's a different conversation than making selfish decisions. They are two different things.
Yes.
But so I think, yeah, we're all living diminished lives when we don't understand that, and when we don't see. And I really came face to face with that, Patrick, when I was leaving that church space for reasons, not only for the beautiful reasons to continue this idea, but also because there was some toxicity present. And when I was pushed to name that toxicity and how it was harming me and how I felt like it was the institution, like itself. And again, that if they would just shift some of those institutional ways that we could have made room for some help, but it ended up being, oh no, like, sorry this hurts you, Melissa, but this is good for me.
Yeah.
Like, it was like you're lifting the veil on something that I don't really want to know about.
Well,
it's like,
and it's so true in what you're saying, I think, in that even when we find ourselves in toxic spaces, in toxic communities, in toxic relationships, even as individuals and even as a group, we find it is so hard for a lot of folks to walk away from toxicity, truly.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're collectively getting better at that, at like saying, okay, what's happening here is toxic. I need to step out. But I think I always often find it very courageous, because that's part of my own story. And especially with my mother, it's like walking away from toxic relationships is so courageous, because sometimes we get comfortable with what's already. And it's like, well, we need to stick this out. We need to, you know, it'll get better. And it's like, no, maybe it's time to walk away. Maybe it's time to walk away.
So yes. So I think and hope will be my first book, which I just have not had or allowed space to start writing. But it's this idea that you're just talking about, and it will be some kind of title about the value of burning bridges.
Yeah.
And it is the idea that you burn bridges, you tear things down, you end relationships, not because you want to destroy something, but because it isn't ultimately working. It isn't, although it may feel good for one side, and this is true if it's an institution with you, like relationships one-on-one or with parties or groups of people or churches or whatever, it may feel good on one side, but that's also false. I used to say like one side feels healthy and the other side, or one side's like, well, we're healthy, but I don't think anybody's healthy in that moment. But anyways, you burn it down, you tear it down. It's also what so many are calling for right now in America. They're asking to end things, not for the sake of wanting to be destructive. You end it so that there is space then to grow, to create, to build something healthy, but it's got to take willing parties on right. both sides. And if you don't have two willing parties, then it is up to you and your health and my health to choose to walk away from it then and end it in that moment. Because the more we stay, the more you're perpetuating harm, not only for yourself, but for others
yes.
that are seeing you, like you're modeling. We're constantly modeling for others, you know, what kind of life we want to live. And that, yeah, I could go on.
Also, yes. That's a very eight book to write.
You're right.
Burn You're right. down the bridges.
I was at Wild Goose Festival, which is like a, you know, justice, spirituality, art festival a couple years ago, doing my talk on the value of burning bridges. And we always do dialogue, which I'm all about. Anything that I'm a part of, I want there to be dialogue. And with Imaginarium, there's always dialogue. So you can push back, ask questions, offer other insight.
Right.
Anyways, we had Q&R at the end of it. And some man was like, this is really interesting because everything else I'm going to hear at Wild Goose ultimately is like the beauty of like building bridges and pushing into each other. And I was like, great, that's also needed. But what I'm talking about is actually accountability. I'm talking about accountability. Oh. I'm not talking about destroying relationships for the sake of watching things burn. Right. It is ultimately about accountability, which I think is needed everywhere, which I think is not often used because of this white idea of perfectionism and the fact that we can't be graded because,
So learning. I think in that book suggestion, you either put a match as a part of the book packaging or yes. some matches. Yeah.
I love it.
There's a lot of things you could do there. That's good. So, okay. here's something that I think is interesting, especially in the work that you're doing now, as it relates to just kind of all the different, you know, in the other houses of worship that exist in even a city like Nashville and around the country, is you all, from what I've seen and what I have, you know, watched online and other spaces, is that music, creativity, arts is of high value, which those of us that know a little bit about little church history, like that yeah. used to be the jam of these faith yeah. places, like that's where a lot of the best art and music and creativity came out of. And like, we kind of lost our way a little bit and it came a little bit dry in some spaces. But I feel like that's something I've noticed. It's like this high care for let's be creative, innovative, you know, let's use this music and theater in all sorts of ways. Like talk to us about that and why that needs to still be the center of any kind of, whether it's the nonprofit gathering like you're doing or any yeah. other kind of spaces where people gather, where that needs to be a part of it in a big way and not just like phoning it in, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. I think art is such a powerful tool and resource. And for those of us where art is actually a part of our lives and our talents, if you will, you know, the 16-year-old Melissa knew that art and using singing in my voice was going to be a useful part of my life. And that has never left me. And I think my time early on in contemporary Christian music, art was often used as a source to inspire people and share this ultimate message about, again, we're back to conservative minded thinking, but right. just this ultimate, like, let's help save people from hell, meaning the afterlife. Like, that was sort of the point.
Right.
And so inviting people into that larger question. Then I realized, okay, wait, but these people are also hurting. Like, these people are facing, you know, they're dealing with, they can't adopt, they can't have kids, or their child has they're having issues with their children or home, or they're having issues with their partners, or they're facing divorce or have been divorced, or they've been let, you know, so on and so forth, or they can't make ends meet at their, you know, at, they can't put food on their table. Right. Like all these actual life, actual, not afterlife, theoretical questions. We're talking about life now. So again, in my journey, in my expansion, as I grew, not just in age, I'm 41 now, but as I grew, like in my mind and entertained and was able to ask better questions, I realized that art can also be used then to not only inspire people to their fullest life, but also to challenge. Mm. Art can be protest. Art can make people see things or feel things in a way that the spoken word often cannot, right, or the read word often cannot. And I see power in both the spoken word and in reading, as I've mentioned multiple times here. But there's just something in music, in drama, in a physical, like artistic representation, like art that hangs on a wall. There's something special and powerful in all of those tools. And so I think they can be used as tools of liberation. That's where art is for me. It is a liberatory tool. And that got reinforced over and over again as I spent time in those prisons with those humans, yeah, and realizing that the art that we were bringing in was one, it was a powerful source of inspiration, and they needed to be inspired. They deserved to be entertained. They had been stripped of art, literally. People behind bars are stripped of anything art, mm-hmm, right? In color, like their walls are white or gray. They see the same things every day. And so anyways, bringing in powerful concerts,
yeah,
was like, let us entertain, inspire, but also let's use these songs to remind them of something powerful. And so it started then, and it's continued with Imaginarium, and it literally seeps into every part of my life. I feel like I could say, like, this is Melissa speaking, or this is what Imaginary believes. This is what I have a thing called Greenhouse Collective now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's ultimately the arts initiative of Imaginary.
Right. That's right.
But it's saying, like, art that inspires life, like your fullest life. And how do we intentionally use art to do that? And so I think it's powerful. When I was working at a church, post my days in Avalon, but when I was at that church, at first many people, and many people still do, they view the musical part of the service, like worship aside, they view that as like the appetizer, if you,
yeah,
will.
Oh, some, wow. Yeah, that's
like,
right.
Meaty thing that's coming versus understanding. And I used to understand this the more I led worship and led people in music corporately, the more I understood, like, that is more so what the people carry with them through the week. It's not necessarily the sermons, especially we gave like heady sermons, and myself included, that I learned under this great communicator who would give like 50-minute sermons, and I later followed in his stead. So that I'm a communicator. I love the power of spoken,
sure,
word, but the songs were often what the people were singing the rest of the week.
Right.
And often the songs were full of things that, one, were not good theology. Ooh, they were teaching some things that were not
talk
good
about
theology.
Talk about it.
Talk about it. And
we just sing them. We just sing them. We just sing them. And we just keep singing them.
We keep singing them. Well, we did. I no longer do.
Yeah, no, you no longer do. A lot of people do.
I remember at the church I was at, we did a hymn sing. Once I grew in being respected there,
sure,
I got, yeah, to plan some concerts, and we did a hymn sing, and because people wanted hymns, right? We were, yeah, in a progressive evangelical at the time. It ended up being maybe post-evangelical church. But they're like, we want hymns, you want hymns. I was like, great, let's do a hymn sing. But what we did was share the background and story of each of those hymns. So one, you could understand,
yes,
you know, when we're singing the words of Amazing Grace that saved a wretch like,
right,
me, we have taken that to be a communal thing that every one of us is wretched, versus understanding that the man that wrote it saw himself as a wretch because he was encouraging slavery and had slaves, and then sort of had this come to Jesus moment,
yes,
if you will, and realized this is not the way I want to be a part of abolishing this. And then he writes Amazing Grace.
Right.
So when he's singing A Wretch Like Me, he's naming like a moment or a season of his life. But we keep singing it over and over and over, and in the meantime, trying to preach on No, But You're the Beloved of God. Like, that gets confusing. Then, sorry, I keep going.
Oh, no, this is good. This is good. No, I like it spicy. Like, this is what we need.
Okay, good, good, good. Then we're singing, like, I'll Fly Away.
Oh, boy.
Which, again, is this, like, ooh, I want to fly away to heaven. And understand the background of that song was sung by slaves, men and women that are literally on the plantation that are living this horrific, damaging, right? They're in a damaging season, a horrible time of life in America. Not that we still aren't. But they are writing these songs because they long to escape. They needed a moment of escape, right? In that moment. And so to honor that and to sing that is one thing. To sing that from a comfortable white pew, pretending like I need to escape my privileged moment and get to heaven, like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So, that. So anyways, power of song, power of words in a song, but just understanding like the how much weight art carries and how can we then better use that intentionally.
Yeah. And what I love too is how even, you know, especially knowing your family a little bit, is that even you all are bringing in an often forgotten art, which is the art of dance. And the art of dance has been in some ways like kind of like pushed away out of our, you know, faith spaces because it's like, oh, that's moving the body. And then we can even, and then there's a whole nother conversation about how the body. And then on top of that, you have, when you think about movement of the body, expressive worship, like call back, yelling and being excited. Those are things that a lot of Black people like to do, Black and brown people, and those became the things that are bad, and we don't want any of that, and we want to be still, and we need to be reverent. And it's like, I love seeing places that say, yes, we want to encourage not only our voices, but our bodies into worship, because guess who, you know, this divine being made our bodies, so we should be using our entire bodies, not just part of our bodies, in this time of worship. And you're exactly right too on when I think about the most like impactful moments when I've been anywhere, it's been because of music. Like I have cried more after a concert or after a worship experience or after any kind of music more than I have cried at just someone standing up and like speaking words. And I love to communicate too. And that's not taking anything away from that art form because it is a beautiful art form, but there is something powerful about music and movement of the body that has been lost for a lot of folks. But
let's come back. I need a part two. Some friends to talk about dance and movement and beauty and embodiment and all of those things that are missing in the world, but are especially missing in religious spaces. But we're back to fear. We're back to fear. Like, wait, but that makes me a little bit uncomfortable because I have this held belief, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
We're missing out.
Yeah. So I feel like we can't, before we get out of here, before we get to our speed round, I think we've did. Yeah. We're obviously going to have you back, but I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't least like, and I'm trying to think of like how to ask this without us going down a rabbit hole, but even if you could say, maybe I'll ask it like this. What would be, because you like, you've kind of alluded to it, like you used to be in the Christian music world for a while and had a good career in that. And I guess maybe for those who are listening, who listen to contemporary Christian music, what would be, if you just could say generally, without like, we're not looking for an expose or anything, but generally saying like, what would be a surprising thing for people to know or understand about that world of contemporary Christian music and as it relates to how you saw it and interacted within it? And that may be a loaded question, so you can take it however you want to take it.
Okay. I think the most surprising thing that, again, people often take things at surface value because the surface is often what serves the viewer, the listener, the whatever. So like, I love this great song, so thus I love this artist so much, it all must be good, right?
Yeah.
We tend to do that.
Yeah.
To understand that CCM world, just like the church is an institution. It is a business. And that does not mean that everybody involved is toxic or right. wrong or bad people, but that industry, because it is an industry, part of institution, it is set up to make money. It is not ultimately set up to do what's good and best in the world, or to allow what's good and best in an artist, or for a platform. It's ultimately creating artists, supporting artists to create platforms that support the product, that bring back a return, which is the money that's being invested in it. So I think that's my,
that's a good word.
Just reminder.
That's a good word.
That's for every.
Oh yeah. And I think, yeah, that's a good reminder. Yeah. That's a very good reminder.
But often people put Christian in front of it and think, well, no, it's all good.
Right.
Well, and it's not. And that's my same critique, if you will, of the church. You know?
Yeah, but that's good. Okay, let's do a speed round here. I call it a speedish round. So we'll start here. This is a question. We'll start here. What's something people seem to misunderstand about you?
So many things. One, that I like to be in control. I don't like to be in control. I just don't want you to be in control of me.
Preach. That's for our eights out there. Let's go, people. That's good. That's good. A few of your favorite quotes.
Oh, okay. Anna Forrest. I learned that I could be both wild and holy.
Ooh.
Literally taped on my mirror.
Oh, good.
The beauty of my life. And then also Hafiz. And again, this brings back to my time in prison and my call to remain with this at the front of my mind. Like, I wish I could show you when you are lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being.
Yeah. Yes. Very good. Albums everyone should listen to.
Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill.
Come on. Yes.
Beyonce's Lemonade, start yes. to finish. For fun and also some good depth, The Greatest Showman. It's so good. All the songs. And Sleeping at Last, Atlas One.
Yeah, that's good. Good picks. One or two books people should read. And we didn't talk about your MDiv. Oh, that's a tragedy. We'll get to it next time.
Okay.
One or two books people should read.
Which some of these are from my MDiv.
Okay, journey, perfect. So, that's great. There we go.
Richard Kearney, Anatheist.
Okay. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Please read it.
Yeah.
Talk to me about it. Find me online. Layli Mappayan's The Womanist Idea changed my world, literally changed my world. And Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, which is a fiction. You need to read it right now in the midst of the pandemics that we are facing in the world, because it'll also change your world.
Perfect. Okay. If you had to leave Nashville tomorrow, what would be some of your must-go-to places before you left town?
Would have to revolve around food at first, because I love food. Shohan Ale and Masala House.
Let's go. That place is so good. Oh,
so good. It's so good. It's our favorite. We go there for all the celebrations, and we've gotten takeout multiple times during COVID.
Yeah.
Jenny's Ice Cream, which I know is sort of everywhere now, but it's a great Nashville favorite. I would have to go to Percy Warner Park and see all the animals and the beauty. And probably one more stop at Roberts on Broadway, because it's an amazing band. Just the band, not necessarily the people in the room,
but
the amazing band and talent that's on that stage.
That's great. That's great. And let's do, if you had to go on a road trip and you could pick any three people, dead or alive, who would be in the car with you?
Beyonce.
Yes.
Michelle Obama.
Yes.
I mean, I would also take Barack, but he's going to be fourth, but I'll take Michelle over Barack. And Madeline L'Engle.
Okay, love it. All right, and then finally, what do you think are one or two kind of keys to a good life?
To be a habitual learner, constantly be willing to learn and grow, to remain grateful, and to savor life, savor each day, moment.
That's great. Melissa, thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. I so appreciate it. This has been fun.
This has been fun. Hey, thanks so much. We'll see y'all next time.